Good evening. My name is Peter Berg. I'm Assistant Head of Special Collections here in the Michigan State University Libraries, and I would like to welcome you to another evening of the Michigan Writers Series. Before we introduce our guest tonight, Lolita Hernandez, I just want to say a few things. As with all Writers Series events, the writer will read for about 45 minutes. Afterwards, there are books for sale, and Lolita has told me she'd be more than happy to talk to you and also to sign any books that you might purchase. So please avail yourself of that. Also, coming up, future events in the Michigan Writers Series, Paul Jakic is going to be here Friday, March 17th, and Paul Clemens from Detroit will be here Friday, March 31st. For those of you who wish to be contacted about these events and any future Michigan Writers Series events, please do sign in with your name and your email, and we will contact you. We'll put you on our e-list and let you know what's happening with the Michigan Writers Series. Without further ado, I'd like to present to you Deanna Rivera, Ethnic Studies Bibliographer at the Michigan State University Libraries, who will present to you our guest tonight, Lolita Hernandez.
Thank you. Thank you. And buenas noches. Welcome tonight. One of the things that I always do is I bring my cell phone up just to remind you that if you do have a cell phone, if you can put it on vibrate, that would be wonderful. I do have the pleasure of introducing our reader, our author for tonight. Her name is Lolita Hernandez. I wanted to give you a little bit of a background about the company that Lolita shares. In 2005, she won the Penn American Center Award. And I don't know if any of you know what it is, but I'm going to read to you a description of what that does, the center does. It is the largest of the 141 centers of International Penn, the world's oldest human rights organization, and the oldest international literary organization. International Penn was founded in 1921 to dispel national, ethnic, and racial hatreds and to promote understanding among all countries. Penn American Center, founded a year later, works to advance literature, to defend free expression, and to foster international literary fellowship. The center has a membership of 2,900 distinguished writers, editors, and translators. Penn American Center builds upon the achievements of such dedicated past members as W.H. Auden, James Baldwin, Willa Cather, Robert Frost, Langston Hughes, Thomas Mann, Arthur Miller, Marianne Moore, Susan Sontag, and John Steinbeck. And in speaking with her earlier today, she mentioned that one of my favorite authors, John Steinbeck, was someone who had influenced her in the past. How many of you here came after reading the description that the libraries posted on Lolita? Okay, well, since the majority of you haven't, then I will go ahead and read what was posted to give you an idea of who it is that we have here. I was going to dispense with it, but I, with so many people not having read it, I'll go ahead. Her poetry and fiction draw from the rhythms and language of her Trinidad and St. Vincent heritage and are tempered by 33 years as a UAW worker, 21 of them at the Cadillac plant in Detroit. She is the author of Autopsy of an Engine and Other Stories from the Cadillac plant, published by Coffee House Press, from which she will be reading tonight. That won her the 2005 Penn Beyond Margins Award. She is the author of two collections of poems, and she told me tonight that they were chapbooks, the collections. One is Quiet Battles, and the other one is Snake Crossing. Her work appears in many literary publications, and she reads from her works nationally and in the Detroit area. She has taught creative writing at the Western Wayne Correctional Facility and compiled the resulting work into an anthology entitled Getting Down: Profiles from Michigan Prison Writers. She has taught creative writing at the Wayne State University Labor School, sociology and composition at the Detroit College of Business, as well as diversity in society online for the Davenport University. She works for the UAW in the UAWGM Quality Network. Lolita has an MFA in creative writing from the Vermont College of Norwich University, a BA in journalism from Wayne State University, a BA in psychology from the University of Michigan, a UAW journeyman card in experimental product engineering layout and assembly. And I can't say that she's most proud of this one, but she emphatically verified that she has a well-deserved BS from the School of Life. So she is an active member of UAW Local 160. San Francisco author Richard Rodriguez wrote this about her book, On Autopsy of an Engine. In her account of the closing of the Clark Street facility of the Cadillac Motor Company, Lolita Hernandez positions herself at the intersection of journalism and literature. Here is not only a report from the assembly line brilliantly told. This is also a talented writer's record of loss, a poet's meditation from inside the working place. And tonight, I won't talk anymore, but I will turn it over to Lolita Hernandez.
Thank you. Wow, since they gave me this thing and I can be like a little bit portable, I'm gonna like stand in front of that table so there won't be as much distance. And I wanna thank all of you for coming out in this incredibly cold, bitter night. And I wanna thank you, Peter and Deanna and John, for having me here and being so nurturing in my time that I'm here. I thought what I would do by way of epigraph is read the title poem from my first chapbook of poems, Quiet Battles. Seems like it would set the stage for the story I'm going to read. Yes, I am a virgin, and I'm reading that for my good friend John back over here. Quiet Battles. All these things make a woman, he said, while beating my stirrings and bruising my hopes. I listened for a long time, but raged my rage through inner ears that echoed, I dream. I dream. I acted for a long time, but raged my rage through sinews that flexed and tensed. I dreamt. I dreamt. I smiled for a long time, but raged my rage through teeth that whispered, I'll dream. I'll dream. These quiet battles added full to my soul, so I prettied my heart and smartened my face, and I survived. Oh, yes, I survived. Yes, I am a virgin. It's told in two voices, so I'll try and modulate my voice a little bit. There is a little mouse standing on its hind legs in the corner furthest from the door of the office where the lady is interviewing me. I can see its nose twitching and its front legs moving nervously. I think to myself, why did you go away if you're so afraid? But it just stands there sniffing the air, and I sit watching it, frozen, because rodents have scared me ever since I was doing my homework in the kitchen of my parents' house when I was 13, and all of a sudden I heard a crinkling noise and I couldn't figure out what it was. And I looked up from a math problem and there were two teeny ears and a piece of a nose peering over the garbage pail in the kitchen by the sink. I ran screaming to my father because my mother was asleep. He said I was a fool. There was nothing to be afraid of. Then he smiled at me and said that he loved me. Then he said I had to continue what I was doing. Would you mind stating your name, job, and social security number for the record? She sounds like she belongs on one of those soap operas I never have time to watch because I'm either at work or when I'm at home, I'm running here and there doing something in the house for the kids. I'm Josie Morgan, Josephine Morgan. My number is 479-381372. I'm just an unskilled factory worker. I do whatever here. When was your first pregnancy? I never know if I'm seeing mice or baby rats. They used to tell me that the little critters scrambling around were baby rats, but I don't know. It was the men telling me this. They'd yell out, "Hey, Josie, there's a baby rat." And I'd yell back, "How can you guys tell it's a rat? Looks like a mouse to me. What is the difference between a baby rat and a mouse?" Did you receive a questionnaire in the mail about any negative experiences you may have had as a result of your pregnancy during your employment at General Motors? I think so, miss. I'm not sure. I don't always read my mail. Sometimes the kids get to it. Sometimes I don't care. Bill collectors, you know, junk mail. From a distance, they look the same, I guess. I don't know. Back then, they just told me I was looking at baby rats. Maybe I was looking at mice and they were fooling me. Do you know why we are questioning you? I wonder if that is a mouse or a baby rat in this office now. I don't think I need this. I wonder if that is a mouse or a baby rat in this office now. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, they're recording. Is it because my voice is so loud? Should I modulate it? Okay. Okay, let's see about that mouse. I wonder if that is a mouse or baby rat in this office now. We are here today because we want to make sure that someone like you has not been missed in the mailing. I was the only woman out of 10 press operators on the hood reinforcement line on afternoons when I started, so they could have been ribbing me a lot. I didn't bother to tell anybody that I was scared to death of mice and rats. We are asking all of the women who hired in before December 1973 whether or not they felt they were discriminated against while they were pregnant as a General Motors employee. Do you understand that? Then again, some people call mice rats because it's all the same to them. There is a difference to me, even though I am afraid of both of them equally. One grows big and one stays little. So seems like I'd be more afraid of rats because they get bigger, especially in the factory. But I am afraid of mice as much as rats because they can sneak up on me. Have you received in the mail any literature about the UAW class action suit regarding the issue of pregnancy in the plant prior to 1973? Oh no, I was already frightened by then. The factory didn't do that. The mice and rats are just here. I always ask myself, if you're so afraid of mice, why do you stay here all this time? What are you talking about? My Jimmy is 7 and Mary is 5, but she's fast as a whip. She's really 5 going on 45. And did you have any problems doing your job during your pregnancies? I did okay with Jimmy, but with Mary I had trouble. Just like a girl, especially that one. She was inside me raising hell. I mean, I was able to stay on the job until the top of the 9th month with Jimmy. What kind of work do you do? I've been doing about the same kind of job ever since I hired in here. I'm a press operator on the hood reinforcement line. When I get the Cadillac hood, it's just sheet metal. Me and whoever my partner is grab the metal, lay it on the press. Then I press my buttons, my partner presses his, and boom, you got a hood, kind of. Next stop on our line, some other stuff gets done, and so on until there's a finished hood. You work the press until your 9th month? This is the first time she looks up at me. I'd like to ask you, did you feel that management at any time made things difficult for you? Did management make you take time off that you didn't want? Miss, what is your name? She looks down again. Did you lose wages because of management harassing you during your pregnancy? Who do you work for, miss? Julia Worthingham, I work for Cadillac Labor Relations. Are you afraid of mice? Mice? No. Mice? I never see them. I don't know. I don't guess so. You work for the company? In a way, yes. I'm an intern in Cadillac Labor Relations. Actually, I'm a student at Detroit College of Law, specializing in labor relations. She smiles at me a little this time. All of a sudden, I feel real stupid. As part of my job, I'm questioning Cadillac women who may have suffered discrimination because of their pregnancy while working for Cadillac Motor Car Company. She doesn't want to hear all that stuff about my girl. All she wants is the facts, like we're in a court or something. Can we get back to the interview? When was your first pregnancy? Let me rephrase that. How many pregnancies have you had? Just then, Rex comes bopping past the foreman's cubicle, where Miss Worthingham is quizzing me. He starts making funny faces at me in the window behind her back. He sort of hikes up his chest, throws his head back. And struts up and down in front of the office, his way of saying that Miss Worthingham looks stiff. What a name, Worthingham. So you had no problems whatsoever with management during your pregnancy. I wonder if Worthingham ever had any kids. I wonder if she ever did any more work than study at school and go around asking people their business. Well, I guess that concludes the interview. No, not yet. My foreman during both my pregnancies was Pete. He was sweet as he could be, one of the few decent foremen around here. He bent over backwards to help me out, though. Like I said with the second one, nobody could really help me. Nature had to take its course. Nature and the good Lord. Miss Worthingham looks at me for a quick minute and sort of scrunches up her eyebrows. I start to feel uneasy about Rex jumping up and down outside the office. Rex stands at the office window looking in. I motion for him to go away. He just stands there. Then Big George comes sauntering by and stares in the window. Then Marianne, Louis, Berta, Max. Here they come, one right after another, peeping in. I get a big smile on my face. The mouse or rat is standing straight up in a corner behind Miss Worthington. I want to laugh, but I don't. Go ahead, Josephine. When was your first pregnancy? Oh, yeah, like I said, no problem with the first. But I had trouble with Mary and had to go out on a medical. I had those fibroid tumors come up, and I kept being in pain, and the doctor said I could miscarry. The first time it happened, I was in my third month and had to stay off work nearly 2 months. Then I went back to school to work. The pain came up again, and I had to go off until I had the baby. Funny thing is, I haven't been bothered by those tumors since. Specifically, what kind of job do you do here? Actually, what kind of work were you doing at the time of your pregnancies? I did whatever. Things were looser on afternoons when the brass went home and left the plant in charge of the foot soldiers. Miss Worthingham was starting to squirm in her chair. There was rhythm on the hood line. Foomp, da-da, foomp, da-da, all together. Foomp, da-da. Josephine, for the record, when were your children born? Two, only two. Could you give me exact birth dates? It's funny how things come back to me all of a sudden. You're here asking me about how it is being pregnant in the plant, and it takes me all the way back to my first day, September 6, 1968. Very well, thank you, Miss Morgan. Just call me Josie. I was fresh out of high school. I couldn't think of what else to do. It's not that I didn't do okay in school. I took college prep courses, but by the time graduation day rolled around, I was tired of studying. I thought I'd go out and make some money for myself, have a good time for a while, then see about hitting the books. I guess I got here and got stuck. You started working here when you were 18? She scared it away when she raised her voice. It went right in between that crack over yonder. It must have been a mouse and not a rat, because I heard that rats aren't limber enough to squeeze through cracks like that critter just did. You will receive a document in the mail within a week summarizing what we have talked about today. I don't want her to stop the interview so soon and to have to go back to the job. I don't want her to be afraid of the clank clank of the presses and the oil and dirt and stuff. She must see something in my face because she twirls her head around so fast I hear her neck bones crack like an old man's. Then she says, "Who are they? What are they doing?" "It's break time, miss." She's starting to look a little nervous. "Please take the time to read the document when you receive it in the mail. Does the plant have your correct address?" "Oh, Miss Worthingham, this is Connor's Stamping, the home of the Cadillac Clowns. We have the wildest, craziest people in all of Cadillac working over here. I think it's because of the noise from the presses, and it's so dark and grimy in here. They don't mean nothing. They're just my good friends, just having a little fun with me." "Very well. Thank you, Miss..." She couldn't have ever had kids. Her body is too slim. Well, maybe she had one and has a maid or a good husband so she can work out at the gym 2-3 times a week. Maybe even 4 times. Can you have a husband and go to school? Who knows with women like her? Anyone with hair that blonde and shiny can't be doing a whole lot of work. If you have had no problem with management during your pregnancies, I sort of linger for a minute, remembering things. I must have had a remembering look on my face because she asked me if anything is wrong. "Yes, miss." She looks at me for a minute, then straightens out some papers. Maybe she is stiff. Really, the only thing that saves her from looking mean is her blonde hair all floofed up around her face. "You can go now. Please tell the foreman to send in Sue James. Thank you." Yeah, the interview office is just like Green's was. Same 2-drawer file cabinet and gray steel desk with a piece of plastic covering notes. A bookcase type of thing with some manuals on top, a gray wastebasket, a phone, and a plug-in radio. Nothing fancy, except the office I am in with Miss Worthingham is beginning to take on some of her perfume smell. "What's the name of the perfume you're wearing, miss?" "L'Interdit by Givenchy." Foreman Green's office smelled like cigar smoke and farts. Green and a couple of other foremen used to hang out there during most of the shift with a couple of janitors. "Do you remember something else?" "The foreman I had when I hired in called me in for a little talk a few days after I started. His office was just like this one, dirty and cramped." "Is this the foreman you have now?" "No, he's not my foreman anymore." "Okay, Josie, have your current foreman send the next person in." I haven't been in a foreman's office in a long time since then. I try to avoid it. That's why I don't come in late or leave early, or get into any kind of trouble, because I don't like a foreman's office. "Do you remember any trouble?" "I saw my first rat in the plant when I walked down the aisle to his office. No mistaking it. Huge, big as a cat." Miss Worthington looked at me over her glasses. "Don't let anybody fool you. Factory rats are so fat, they're sassy. People around here leave food for them just like their pets. If somebody drops some food on the floor or something, they just leave it for the rats. We got cats around here too, but they're not up to handling the rats. Too skinny, can't get to the food." "Did they frighten you with rats during your pregnancy?" "No, ma'am, I was already afraid of them." She works for the company. No wonder we are having this interview inside the plant. I thought if she were with the UAW,
we would meet at the local or some other place away from the plant. We are here today because we want to make sure that someone like you has not been missed. Thank you, Miss. My name is Josephine. Are you afraid of mice or baby rats or big rats? Rats? No rats. I never see them. I don't know. I don't guess so. You know, I looked good like you when I hired in. My hair was nice and shiny, blonde like yours. I had a figure. Can we get back to the interview? Just then, Green, the foreman, comes by the office. He looks through the window behind her back and makes a funny face at me. He puts his hands by his chest and moves them up and down like he had boobs there. Then he throws his head back and laughs. Miss Worthington looks at me for a long time. Josie, is there any chance I might run across one of those rats today? I'm so careful about where I walk in here, I say to myself, that I take the same path every day to let the rats know they should walk someplace else and stay out of my way. I work for Cadillac Relations. Maybe we can get the plant cleaned up. I had to laugh. Miss, you've probably run across a dozen or so two-legged rats already in this place, especially good-looking as you are. What? That's all Miss Worthington says. Her mouth hangs open, and she is on the edge of her chair. You see, Miss, Bill Green called me into the office. I thought to give me some kind of orientation or job instructions. He had me sit in a chair, looked me up and down, and asked me if I was a virgin. What? Yeah, he asked me if I was a virgin. What did you do? What did you say? I told my mother. She said to pray. I went to church that Sunday and prayed. I'm Catholic, you know. What happened then? What did he do? What did he say? Bill Green called me into the office 2-3 more times. I was so young then. The last time he called me in the office, which was about my second week in the plant, I just blurted out, yes, yes, I am a virgin. So what? It's none of your business anyway. He said for me to go do whatever. He said that I was a fool. I ran out of the office. I caught a glimpse of him over my shoulder, laughing at me. Did you tell anyone what happened? Did you tell his boss? By break time that night, damn near everybody in the place was calling me a virgin. Look, I'm just an intern from Detroit College of Law. Maybe because I'm a white girl and I got along so well with the black guys, he was testing me or something. Did you have any problems specifically while you were pregnant? I've been doing about the same kind of job ever since I hired in here. Like I told you, I'm a press operator on the hood reinforcement line. When I get the Cadillac hood, it's just sheet metal. Me and whoever my partner is grab the metal, lay it on the press. I press my buttons, and my partner presses his. The die goes down, and there's the hood, kind of. Next stop on our line, some other stuff is done, and so on, until there is a finished hood. There's rhythm to our line. Foomp, da-da, foomp, da-da. You will receive a document in the mail summarizing what we have discussed about your pregnancies. After that, everybody wanted to know who my boyfriend was, who I was fucking. It was embarrassing having my business out in the street. Things died down for a while until I got pregnant. Then there it was again. Folks were saying, guess you're not a virgin now. Please sign the document. Of course, you're new here and still so young, being a lawyer and all. How folks treat you around here might make a difference to you. I assume the plant has your correct address. Return the document in the envelope provided. But for me, now that I've had a couple of kids and a couple of bad husbands to boot, I just take everything in stride. The men in here hardly mess with me anymore. I guess they figure I'm no day at the beach, so why bother? Please ask your foreman to send in Susan James. Oh, they might tease me about my weight or tell me I can't keep a man or offer me a few bucks in trade now and then, especially after they've been drinking. One time they put a dead rat in a box and gave it to me at Christmas. But I just do whatever I have to do to make it in life, and everything else rolls right off my back. Thank you. I will tell you that that story was generated around the Clarence Thomas, Anita Hill thing, and everyone in the plant was going around. At that time, assembly was closed, and it was just, we were few still on Cadillac, because I was with the engineering building doing that trade that Diana said. I never know what it's called. Anyway, everyone was going around, the men were saying, if we say this to you, is that sexual harassment? If we do this, is that sexual harassment? Well, anyway, the women were talking, and one of them sort of gave me the kernel of the story, and then I just sort of mushed in all the pregnancy stuff and all of that. Found me some nice Detroit College of Law attorney, and threw her in there, too. Do you have questions? I'm glad you raised that because I started in the plant in 73, and about that time there was a real influx of women, and the culture changed over a period of time. As women, you know, there's power in numbers, and pretty soon we had a little bit more strength. I don't want to say that we weren't experiencing a lot, but towards the end, I think there's probably a little bit of difference now. I mean, I think it was more raw then at that point. When I first started in the trades, I was the only woman, and they weren't very happy at all to have us, and there was a lot of harassment. Then four other women came in after me, and we sort of banded together, and by the time we'd been there a few years, there was more acceptance. But I was by my old Local 22, the other day and met a young woman who's just starting in an electrical trade, and oh my gosh, the kinds of things that were being said to her sounded like the same sort of stuff that was said to me in 78. So it's like, you know, one step forward and two steps back. So I don't know. I don't know what it means. And, you know, I don't know how tense things are going to get as people feel really threatened by their jobs. You know, maybe there's probably a lot of resentment because here's a woman coming into a good-paying trade and here all these job problems are going on. And there's still a tendency to think that, you know, the man should be the one making the money. They used to tell me that all the time. I'd say, yeah, well, get me one. Did I see your hand?
Yes. As far as the correctional facilities, how open are inmates in sharing their lives on paper?
That's a really, really good question. I think It's that workshop was done, if you can imagine, like as a typical writer facilitator, you're going to tell people to journal, because I mean, for me, journaling is like where everything, you know, comes out of, keeps the wrist soiled and everything, and your mind going on things. And how do you write a journal in a prison, and then where do you put it so that nobody gets it, and so on? So. But they managed to do that. And then the other thing is like sharing, being able to share in the classroom setting. So I just had to establish some boundaries that, you know, we were all writers and we were all there to help each other out. There's no right or no wrong. When you critique someone's work, start with the positive. And Because if you're going to really write, you have, you know, things have to be able to come out. You can imagine I'm, you know, this woman standing up there wearing very long dresses, and completely swaddled, no perfume, no makeup, standing up there trying to deal with this. And if issues, sexual issues come up or something like that, then you have to, you know, it has to be in the course of their writing, then, you know, they should be able to raise that, and it should be handled in a manner that is beneficial to everyone. And a lot of really incredible material came out. One of the gentlemen in the program admitted to being sexually abused by his cousin. I mean, it's just all kinds of material that came out that, you know, here it is, you're with all these men, and they're bringing this material out. So they made some pretty good strides, some incredible strides, I thought, anyway. So if you don't have the book, contact me. I don't know if that answered your question or not.
To some extent, just like their comfort level and laying stuff out on paper. I mean, I'm sure no one's going to say, yes, I murdered him, and turn that into a story.
Well, one thing you learn to do is to not go in there and say, what are you here for? I don't want to know. It's like, I don't want to know. It's not about that. So I don't think that was necessarily the kind of, you don't want to get into that. Besides, everyone's innocent anyway. So did you get that?
They were framed.
They were all framed anyway. That I always draw back on.
My sister's a writer, and she always draws back on the suicide of that. And she says every story she writes, even though it's not about suicide at all, you always go back to this for her. It's what comes out like emotionally that she can write about all
different. Yeah, that's and your sister's quite right. I mean, Octavio Paz says that a writer is always writing the same story over and over again. What is the story that I'm writing? What am I writing about? I don't know. I guess I'm always trying to, trying to figure out why things happen the way they do to people. Maybe I'm trying to figure out why my life has gone the way that it's gone. Various things that have happened, and I think probably I'm always looking inside of my characters for an answer to that and how they're relating to each other. So I think. Because I'm always trying to figure that out about myself, I think my characters are always trying to figure that out about themselves. The collection of stories I'm working on now is just about Detroit. The other thing is I have a lot of problems with separation anxiety. I don't like to separate from people, from friends, or, you know, relationships and so on and so forth, and that, and I think like that book, this book here was written out of a profound sense of grief, not just being worried about the plant, or about, you know, if I was going to have a job or something, but a real deep sense of grief. And there were others grieving as well. They didn't necessarily have a place to put it. I cannot tell you how many grown men sat there and cried in front of me about what was happening with the closing of the plant and how were they going to support their families and what was going to happen. A marriage broke up, and it was like an amazing emotional time. And fortunately, I was just able to write about it and put the grief. And I think I'm in the process of grieving for Detroit, not for Detroit, but for me leaving Detroit, because it's probably in my future, just as I retire and so on and so forth. And then I'm just looking at the city in a different way, and I'm just sort of looking at all this stuff and saying, well, what does this really mean, and who was I in Detroit? How much of me is Detroit, and so on and so forth, all that kind of stuff. They say a writer is constantly reliving the same thing over and over and over again. It's obsessive.
There's a, in our generation, there's a literature of, about the plants. It has to do with desperation, certainly depression, the horror of working in a job that's, that never ends. It's unpleasant, it's unfulfilling. And so now we have the death of the big three. Everyone buys foreign cars, the middle class is dying. So we have people lined up to get our plant jobs. If you can get into General Motors or Ford or anything, for some people it's the biggest joy in their lives. So the question I have would be, is it a different thing now? What do you say about that? And is it that much better to work in a Toyota plant?
Is what a different thing now, working in the plant?
Your work has a certain tone to it that says this is, there's rats there, this is an awful place. What I'm saying is in Lansing, you know, they're overjoyed that there's going to be they're building on the General Morris plant. People are lined up on lists and will never get to work there, the best job they could possibly get in their lives. And in our generation, it was like, for me, it was, well, you can go to, if you want a factory, go to Vietnam, or you go to college, and maybe stay away from Vietnam. But everyone will get in the factory. So now it's a great job with benefits that no one will ever have.
Hey, it was a great job then. It was a great job then because you were getting, I mean, the workers had to fight for some bennies and for some better wages, but it was still a great job, even though you had to feed the rats extra and all that kind of stuff. It was still a great job because those jobs put, you know, your kids through schools. I mean, you've got auto workers running around here, you know, with boats and big homes and driving caddies and so on and so forth, driving Saturn views like me, you know. But
anyone writing it though in our generation is not, they don't, things I've read, like the guy called himself Gearhead, who's in Detroit, wrote those books.
Rivethead.
Yeah, Rivethead.
Rivethead, Ben Hamper.
It was never a positive experience. I mean, you were in an awful plant, doing awful work, and, you know, and everyone was exploited.
And I'm going to tell you something. I'm going to be extremely candid with you, too. I mean, I have a different perspective. I am a woman. I'm a woman of color, and I'm looking at everything totally different. I mean, I'm just not going to talk about the machines and how awful everything is in there. But as a matter of survival, I'm going to talk about, like, the relationships that are built up in the plant that help you survive and how it is you survive. Even writing the book itself is a question of survival, like, you know, on a certain level. So, and I think that's a very big difference. It's not, it's not to be taken lightly, as far as I'm concerned, that I'm going to write in this situation and pull out of it something entirely different than probably the average man does. I don't know. I've never worked in a Toyota. You're talking to a GM worker. No. It did not. But they're not better cars. No, they're not better car. I don't know.
What kind of campus where people buy from cars? They don't buy them because they think it's convenient. So you buy more expensive foreign cars.
Yeah.
Although all our salaries are paid by
them. I know. People don't get it. It's people being removed from.
Do you feel loyalty to the plant? Do you feel loyalty to the
job? Absolutely. Absolutely, it's because that's what's been feeding me for 33 years.
Yeah. So it bothers you when people say American cars are bad.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, I'm not supposed to say that though. I'm supposed to have this kind of really internationalist workers' perspective that says we are all workers, and not only that these ruling class bourgeois folks are running around the world, sleeping in each other's silk beds, sheets, and you know, getting money from each other, and they're all on the same boards and everything, so it doesn't really make any difference. But it makes a difference to me because I'm building a car. I'm going to support that car. I'm not buying a Ford. I'm not buying a Chrysler. I'm not buying a Toyota. I'm not buying anything like that. And most workers are like that, although you see a few who do cross over. We deal with them.
Well, I've got to comment on the fact that it hasn't always been a literature of desperation.
Yes.
Your book is a book about solidarity. Jim Daniels' work is often about solidarity.
Solidarity, yeah.
So that it's been a mixed experience. Every one of the drug crazed Rivethead, I mean, yeah, you know,
Yeah.
You have that on one
side. I didn't want to say that, but.
There's your book on the other side that really talks about the kind of bonds that would have people break down in tears at the plant closing.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, in that way, I think that it's been anything schizoid, you know, in a variety of different ways about people's feelings about what they were doing inside the plants. And I think your work really reflects that very well.
Thank you. I mean, I feel that. I don't feel like, you know, happy all the time about some of those days in the plant were just like, they were awful, especially when you were pregnant. I mean, some of the things that you would go through, these foremen, it was just amazing. How primitive that got. I mean, I can't tell you some of the really primitive struggles I got through where I'd have to be up in somebody's face talking like a sailor to back them down. You know what I mean? And just, you just have to do it or else.
How does your coworkers think about you being a writer? I mean, it's interesting that you have kind of a dual role, and do they read it and recognize themselves in your work, or I mean, how do they respond to it?
There's been a lot of support for it, and that's really a good question because I've been, my coworkers were my early audience as I started to write factory poems, because I've been writing poetry for a long time, even though I never really considered myself a writer at all. It just, you know, it was more of an avocation. It wasn't even. And then when I started writing about the factory, I'd make them listen to it. And then when I started reading out in public, I'd make them come. So I had this little. And then when this book came out, there's been an incredible amount of support for it from the. From the workers, they feel like, wow, we always thought these stories needed to be told, and someone told them, you know. And there's support for the Rivethead book, too, you know, because he describes, it's funny as all get out, and he really captures the craziness. But I'll tell you what my idea of art is that don't tell me what I already know. I mean, so for me, it's like, well, I already know that. I mean, that's what I'm always looking for is, like, what is beyond that? You know, what's the other connection? How are we pushing the boundaries to understand ourselves in this human condition, in this world that we find ourselves? It's just another part of the world. You know, that's a world, part of the world that people live in, and it's a world in and of itself. And I think ultimately, if we're not asking ourselves why we're here and what's going on and what are the connections with stuff, then we're just, you know, you might as well strip down and go to those concentration camps they're getting ready for you. Did I say something wrong?
It's all being taken, okay. I'm curious how you decide whether to make a poem or a short story out of an experience.
I really don't know how that happens. I think it just happens. Going back to Octavio Paz once again, he says that the first line of anything that you write, well, he was a poet, so, right? The first line of the poem is a gift from God, right? And the rest of it, you're on your own. So I kind of just sit there, and somehow or the other, I can feel when something is a poem and something is a short story. And then I've gotten so that I'm sort of realizing when something is really a novel. So I got to that point a few years ago, just to give you an amusing story over here. I got to that point a few years ago. I pretty much finished this collection. I was just continuing writing, no hope of getting anything published. We don't even think about that, right? And I started this writing what I thought was another story for the collection, and it kept going and going. I said, oh my God, this is a novel. And I got so afraid. I was like, and I wrote it. I wrote this whole thing. And it's in a dark closet in the corner. I wrote it, and I discovered a lot about what not to do when writing a novel, how not to position yourself emotionally, what kind of space you need. To be able to do that, and so on and so forth. But I do know that I did feel that difference between writing short story and writing. The other thing is Jorge Luis Borges, who's absolutely one of my favorite writers, says that a short story is plot driven, and a novel is character driven. And I really have experienced that, and I really feel that even from that something that I wrote, which maybe I can revive someday. I really felt the difference. The poem?
And what are poems? I mean, you say short stories.
I think in poetry you have the ability to have a more immediate emotional experience. Poets say that, and I've kind of felt that myself. It's like really, if something happens, like, you know, tonight, I can't go home and start a story. It's going to be jacked up. I've got to think about things and sit on it and stew on it. And years down the line, I might be looking at this gentleman right here in the back, and something will register about him. And 5 years later, that hat and those glasses might end up in a story. You know what I mean? You never know how that's going to go. So stories, because the relationships are so different. At least that's, I think I'm more of a story writer than a novel writer. The other thing I will say, too, that for a few writers in here, that I think you read what you want to write. So I think that I hardly ever read poetry. So somewhere along the line, it dawned on me that I'm probably just an occasional poet. But I love reading stories. And I really love losing myself in a novel. Because it's like, wow, you've got some place to be for a period of time until you're finished with that. So. Maybe not, but.
Has that ever made its way into your stories? Or is that something that's, something that you've dealt with?
Yeah, I think I have that. And I think this is our song for today, talks about the young men getting drunk and how the engine got off the line or something like that. But I like to tell people it's a war zone. You know, they boogie them up when they send them to Vietnam, when they send them to Iraq, when they send them wherever they want to send them to fight. You know, they boogie them up in the plant. I mean, and in the plant is like, it's a city. You can get anything in there. Anything. I mean, anything. I mean, you can get married in there. You can get divorced in there. You can buy your home there. You can buy your swimming pool there. You can get your drugs there. You can get, whatever rum you want. I mean, anything that you want. Actually, one Christmas, I did my entire shopping in the plant. Never went because we were working like a lot of overtime.
Well, the perception of the American auto is a rock and stone. Doesn't work Monday or Friday. Builds bad cars that Americans won't even buy.
That is the perception of the auto workers.
Bad cars that aren't as good as Japanese cars.
But it's not the workers. It's management, and design. I mean, it's not the workers. I mean, I can't tell you how many times we'll tell them that scrap, that's not good material, and the poor guy, the poor line foreman wants to make his quota for the day, and so he can impress somebody or so he can survive or something, and they'll run scrap. Not only that, because I've been able to see this a lot because the program I work in now is a planned maintenance program. So it's actually GM's a little bit more advanced, I think, than the other U.S. automakers on this. So it's a program where they try and have a process and a cadence and an attention to maintaining the equipment that creates the parts that creates the cars. And so they're getting a little bit better at equipment that they actually, maintain, that they have a planned preventive maintenance approach to that equipment, which is kind of something that they weren't really doing. I mean, you'd have some old rickety machine that could kill you and then turn out scrap parts. And even now, they fight you.
Toyota plant, though? Non-UAW. American workers cars are better? That workforce is better? Cars are better?
I don't know. There have been some Toyota recalls lately.
I'm asking. I don't know.
I don't know.
Is the UAW bad then? It makes it so safe that they don't make as good cars?
No. We're American workers. And I'll tell you what, try living without the UAW.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I can only base my opinions on my experience. And I don't know so much that the American public thinks that American cars are that bad. I know I don't. Not anymore, actually. And I say not anymore because I had three brother-in-laws, two brothers, four compadres that worked in the plants, and I heard those stories, and I'll tell you, I wouldn't buy a car during the time that they were working.
I wouldn't have bought a Friday Cadillac either myself. I don't know. They're probably just as bad. I mean, it's the same workforce.
Yeah, on Fridays, anyway.
Management is management. I don't care what they say. They want a buck, and they want a buck off of you.
We're getting kind of close. I don't want to cut off any questions, but I just wanted to let you know that I pulled out some of the books there. And please, if there's any more questions, please go ahead.
Let me just do a quick commercial. If any of you are not on our mailing list for our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives, that brought Lita to town the first time. Feel free to come. We do a brown bag series, we do poetry readings, film openings, other kinds of things. All it has to do with women's culture brought to time. So please do come around if you're interested.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank all of you.